now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Jolene Jordan off for the evening. And next Sunday, no show. I'm going to be traveling, and Jolene doesn't want to do the show by herself anymore. I don't know what's with that woman. In fact, why don't you do this? If you want Jolene to do the Night Call talk show all by herself, text. Now, actually, no, can't give you her text, can I? Email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And just put in the subject line, do the show, Jolene. Or Jolene, do the show. That sounds a little better. She's going to kill me, right? She's going to kill me. She's going to say I'm putting pressure on her. But, hey, if you're joining us for the first time, this is WRIF's phone-in talk show. I'm Peter Werby. My usual co-host is Jolene Jordan. As I said, she's off for the evening. And we would like to listen to that, the plural. But I can say we because John is still screening your calls at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And how do I follow Super Bowl 47? That's pretty tough. I mean, the celebration is still going on. Baltimore just snatching it, snatching, I don't know, what would you say, victory from the jaws of defeat almost, right? San Francisco coming back and just by a squeaker, missed it. And, yeah, I'll tell you the truth. I'm not can I say this and still have some cred available? That I'm not a super big football fan. When the Lions are involved, it's a little bit of a different story. But two teams that don't mean too much to me. I don't get real excited. And the other thing is that but you can get excited about Super Bowl Sunday, and you get all your friends together, you have parties and what have you. But you and 110 million other people in the United States are watching. So it's like America's party, except I'm doing show prep. Yeah, and I have been for not the last 47 Sundays, to be sure, when Super Bowl was on. But, you know, I have to do show prep. No way I could get out of it. I've missed a lot of things during my career because Sunday night, can't do it. Say, come on over, we're going to, I don't know, fill in the blank. And even when I was single, never mind. We won't go there. By the way, John, who is getting your calls at 313-298-WRIF on a subject yet to be announced, although if you'd like a career in radio, you can take Jolene's place and get on the air early. I may do that. Usually we yak for about a half an hour, but this time, tonight, because she's out and because there won't be a show next week, try to get as many of you on as possible. My great fear, though, is, of course, and I probably shouldn't even say this, is that 90% of the audience is still watching the Super Bowl wrap-up and all the big celebration and the big Tiffany trophy and what have you. So you can do this as well. Go to Facebook.com/nightcall, and there's lots of good things happening there. You can weigh in with your opinion and see some of the stuff we've posted. And at some point, let me see if I can do that right now. Let me do this rather than go there. I should introduce some subjects. Always the advertisements for the Super Bowl. Everybody gets nuts about those. These were rather than being a surprise, these were let early in the game, and they were they were available on the internet, I guess. These companies that are paying this fortune for them figured, well, rather than just my 30 seconds of fame, I'll get it out there. And if I can do the right thing, it'll go viral. Go viral or go home, right? And so now Coca-Cola is embroiled in the latest advertising controversy for going too far on air and online with what's called an offensive spot. Now, I saw that. I'm pretty sensitive to these things. And it takes place in the desert. There's this huge Coca-Cola bottle. And then there's these cowboys, and then there's this kind of bus full of showgirls, And then, I don't know, what would you call them? Badlanders, maybe bikers or something like that. But there's also, looks like a Northern African, an Arab on a camel. Well, which, you know, that may be the stereotype. So a lot of Arab American community groups have issued complaints. And let me see, there's something called the Muslim Institute for Interfaith Studies. Iman Ali Siddiqui said the Coke commercial for the Super Bowl is racist, portraying Arabs as backward and foolish camel jockeys, and they have no chance to win in the world. You know, you could read that, by the way. You know, when you're not in that position, when you're in a majority group, it's real easy to say, oh, come on, they're being way too oversensitive. And when it's about somebody who is more on the margins of society, or sometimes even is a despised minority, or despised minority for certain sectors of the majority group. So, and then we say, you know, the us and the majority say, oh, they're being way too sensitive. I don't know how to cut it. It certainly has those qualities that portrayed Arabs as backward and foolish and camel jockeys. Well, he had a camel. I don't know how many people. I mean, there's still camels operating in that part of the world, but when they started racing, when this busload of showgirls and these cowboys on horses, and why I'm even forgetting. I guess so. Are they bikers? I can't even remember. I think so. They're going off to get the coke, and of course, the Arab on the camel is left in the dust. So, you know, read what you want. But here, and I don't know what you can do if you're in that position. If you feel you're part of an offended group, because what did they do by their protest? The whole thing went viral, and everybody wanted to see it. So Coke was making these pious statements. They said, oh, you know, we're not trying to offend anybody, and we support the diversity and all that. In the meantime, they must be just rubbing their hands going, oh, this is terrific. Everybody's going to watch this thing. So whatever, as they say. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Let me see. What else did I see? I saw the Doritos ad with this goat. I mean, getting excited about ads. Wow. I don't know what to say about that. There's any number of things that are worthy of talking about, but give me a show. Give me a show at least that there's some of you out there. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com or give a call, even better, 313-298-WRIF. Don't want to talk about the game at all. Drew and Mike, tomorrow morning, beginning at about 5:30 or 6 a.m. here on WRIF, they will be talking about it. And so tune into that as well. Well, one of the things, I'm getting a regular postal mail correspondent. You may remember last show, if you're a regular listener, that I mentioned that there was somebody who sent me a photograph of their room, or somebody's room. John is reminding me of this ad. That's right. About the nerd kissing the hottie in the GoDaddy ad, if you can get all the slang there. GoDaddy is this website hosting company and all that. It was a funny ad because there's this absolutely drop-dead young woman kissing, even kind of worse than a nerd, someone who you would have to consider under contemporary standards of what makes a male attractive, didn't make it. And I was thinking that people were going, oh, man, how can she kiss that toad? And, you know, maybe she was hoping he would turn into a prince. But, you know, when you're in love, when you're attracted to somebody, everybody is a prince and a princess. So it was, these ads, in a way, everybody is kind of the butt of it, right? And not all of them, but in this one as well. I mean, the GoDaddy ad, which shows this beautiful woman kissing an unattractive nerd, and, I mean, they're really sucking face, too. I mean, this isn't just a little kiss on the lips, man. They're you know, one of those things. So the root of it is, oh man, how can she kiss that guy? Which isn't nice. You know, everybody's not beautiful. Everybody's not, handsome. And, they're for every boy, for every girl. Wasn't there some like 1950s song like that? Anyway, where was it? Oh yeah. So I have this, correspondent who, when I've been denouncing the Confederate flag as the symbol of the greatest, the biggest traitors in American history, responsible for over 600,000 American deaths. Just think how we hate Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. That were responsible for the deaths of over 3,000 Americans. And here, this battle flag of the Confederacy, these people that went to war to defend the possession of slaves, that it's flown by people that usually consider themselves American patriots as well, which is hard for me to understand. How can you say this, the pledge to the flag, the pledge of allegiance to the flag and to the nation for which it stands, one nation, indivisible. Indivisible means it can't be divided, can't, no, you can't secede and all that. And then fly that, that ghastly rag, right? Anyway, I've got a good eye for handwriting. So the same person sent me another piece. And one thing I ought to tell him, that I'm not quite sure how to do it on your printer, but unless you're into spending a whole lot of money, you've got to learn how to turn off your color function and just print with black ink only, because it's going to cost you a fortune. I mean, I just bought a new incredible printer that does everything under the sun, it was $110. And, of course, what they want to get you on is the ink cartridges, even though those are dropping in price as well. But in any event, appreciate it. This is Obamacare is bad for you if you're a smoker. And it's this hysterical article. Well, let me say this. It may not be. What it's talking about is that under President Obama's Affordable Care Act, most people call it Obamacare, which apparently he does not care about anymore, that millions of smokers may have be subjected to fees costing thousands of dollars, making it more expensive for them, for those Americans, than people that don't have that unhealthy habit. And some Obamacare premiums for smokers could cost 50% higher than anyone else starting in January 1st, 2014. Not 100% sure that's true because, you know what? Because of the compromises that had to occur in Obamacare, it's this bureaucratic nightmare. So to some extent, the criticisms of it were a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Every other country worth its industrial definitions as being a first world country has a pretty simple healthcare situation. You just, you know, you get a card, you walk in there, you say, hey, I'm sick, or I need an operation, or what have you. And you don't have all of this. You don't have these private insurance companies anymore. But because the unwillingness to give up this medical system that is harms tens of millions of American people, we got the best health care in the world and one of the worst health care systems in the world. Because and why do I say we have? Let me see. Did I bring up my email? I hope I did. Because, oh no, I haven't yet. I'll have to get to it. Because, we rank real low. We, the United States, rank real low in the world in terms of healthcare that's afforded to our citizens. Everyone else takes it as a matter of right. So, I would not panic. I have no idea what's gonna go on with it. I think the registration for insurance under Obamacare is going to begin in October of this year, and then it'll click in. Now, lots of people have already done real well on it. If people could stay on their parents' policy, if your parents have a policy till they're 26, the stuff about pre-existing conditions has gone away, and it's possible. Well, let me put it this way. I think this is exactly what the Republicans and the right wing fear, is that this Obamacare is the thin wedge which rather than when people start being faced with its failings, will say, hey, we got to get rid of this and go back to what was, which means tens of millions of people uninsured and tens of millions more people with inadequate health care, saying we'll go back to that, they're going to say, you know, we need a greater government health care program. Like they have in Canada, like they have in Britain, like they have in France, Italy, or should I name all the rest of the countries in the world, and we are the sole people without it? All right, I won't do that, but that really is the case. All right, well, here, I said I would take some calls, and we only have one call at 313-298-WRIF, which makes me fearful that people are still watching the aftermath of the Super Bowl. But it's Mike and Fenton. Mike, hi. It's Peter, without Jolene, you're on the air. What's up?
Yeah, I was going to talk about Jolene next week, but you brought up that health care. It's affordable health care because they're going to take our money, and the government will spend less money on health care because they're going to be using our money.
Well, I don't. So, unless you're very, very wealthy, Mike, they're not going to be using your money, and they're not going to be using my money. They're going to the tax for Obamacare is going to come out of the top 1%, which is fine with me.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's wonderful. As far as Julian goes, though, she should do the show next week, and they should get Kid Rock or Bob Seger to do it with her.
Okay. Well, why not? Yeah, we bash the kid about his politics some, so yeah, maybe we get him on that. We do what they call point counterpoint. At one time, we were actually thinking about like me and Ted Nugent, but he's so insane, I would probably, big a blabbermouth as I am, I'd probably never get a word in edgewise with the, he's not the Motor City Madman anymore. What's that little town he lives in where Bush lives?
Yeah, I forgot, somewhere in Texas, I've been right there, it's right by Waco.
Yeah. A Waco in Waco. I love it. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. 313-298-WRIF, here's Shannon. Shannon, hi, you're on the air, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. What's up?
You know, I want to talk about Beyonce tonight. After her whole lip-syncing accident, let's talk about the halftime show.
Yeah, I heard she was great. I missed
it. Did you not see it?
I said earlier, I had to prepare for this show, so I just couldn't do it. I couldn't take the time away. But
all right, well, let's say this. She did a great job.
Yeah?
There was a lot of recording there. But she got a little bit of Destiny's Child back in there, which is a great thing, don't you think?
Well, she is one of the more beautiful women on the planet, and she's a great singer. So, I'm all about her. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to see it. I mean, I know it was all recorded, so I'll see it after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, even I can agree with that. She's a beautiful woman. She's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's good. Yeah, she's all over the place. The inauguration, halftime at the Super Bowl. Wow, it's big. All right, Jenna, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Now, I was watching tonight, one of the things I always do. I never learn much from television news, to tell you the truth. Actually, except with so many Americans, The Daily Show. That's the only place I really would say I learn things significantly. But I always like to watch the news to see how things are presented, how they're presented and how they're, what's the word I'm looking for, how they're positioned, whether things I think are important make it onto the news, and if they are, how are they presented, all that, right? So they had this thing that I've been meaning to bring up for the longest time, and they were talking about student debt, and we've talked about this a lot, and this was staggering. They were interviewing this woman, young woman, hadn't even graduated college from can't remember the college. Some not one of the big UC colleges, University of California campuses. But she's going to leave school with a debt of $120,000. A debt of $120,000. Now, many of you who are in college now or maybe in your lower or mid-20s, if I said to you, hey, I'm going to get you a job for 30 grand a year, you'd say, wow, that's very cool. I would take that in a second. So I was thinking that if she got a job for $30,000, an entry-level job when she's like 22 or 23, just out of college, and it didn't look, you know, she didn't look like she was going to, like a grad student, just you know, undergraduate student, that if she didn't spend any of her money at all, it would take her 4 years of all of her money. Well, I mean, she couldn't even do that because you'd have to pay taxes on her $30,000. But I don't know how much you can give away. I don't know how much you can give away at a what do you call it? And still live. Let's say she could give $5,000 a year. And, I mean, at that rate, well, Jalene always tells me, don't do the math on the air. I can't even begin to do it. $5,000 paying off $120,000. If it was 10, it was, like, what, 24 years, right? Maybe that, is that right? Something like that, but a long time. And you could say, I mean, one of the things that happens if somebody actually makes it into something resembling a profession that isn't looking to cut everybody's salaries and benefits, as so many places are these days, you know, when you're, say 25 and making, pardon me, $30,000 a year. Hopefully, in today's dollars, by the time you're 45 or so, you'll be making, you know, $50,000-$60,000 at least. So she could begin to pay. But what kind of thing is that to do to the next generation? To stick them with debt? To stick them with debt? This is too long, maybe even too personal a story. But I actually started off when I was 23 years old and got married with a sum of money that I won in a lawsuit. And the details, they probably are interesting. Well, I don't know. I'd have to let you be the judge of that. But I'm not going to give them. But that set my wife and I off in fine stead for the rest of our lives. And on the opposite, if I would have been all of a sudden, they say, okay, Pete, you owe $120,000. I don't know. I mean, I'd still be paying for it, I guess. And so here's this article in where's my little note here? I actually copied down some note. The student loan debt now is closing in on $1 trillion. That's what you owe if you're, you know, college age or completed college and what have you. $890 billion is out in student loans, and like a third of people are in arrears. They're not even going to pay it. And so, when you think of what's big debt in this country, like credit cards, well, student loan debt is bigger than credit card debt or car loan debt. So this is amazing. So we are sucking this money from our young people, from our next generation, for people that should be, I don't know how many of you owe money or have owed money or have been in a situation where you owed money and couldn't pay. It's not like you owe it to a loan shark, you know, but still, I've owed money and been in some harrowing circumstances because I couldn't come up with the money. Not physically, I didn't owe it to loan sharks. And it's bad on your psyche. It hurts the brain. It's no good for you emotionally. And so here's somebody just starting out in the world, rather than going into this lucrative field. They've taken all this training, and probably 10 years ago or 5 years ago even, it probably would have paid a third more, and you would have 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 30 years ago, you would have had a great job with fixed benefits and all that. And instead, you're saddled with this debt, maybe to the point where you've got to still live with your parents. There's something very wrong here. Now, this was an article a while ago I've been carrying around, never really got to it. It says, financial worries pile on long before graduation. And this is from the New York Times. Oh, my Gaia. It's from November 14th, but I don't, you tell me, those of you who are facing this, either as students or parents or someone who's considering school. I mean, it also almost makes sense not to go to college. I mean, $120,000, you know, that's years worth of the money you're paying back and the interest on it. That's years worth of income. Money troubles interfere with the academic performance of about one-third of all college students, and a similar number of students regularly skip buying required academic materials because of the cost. In an era of stagnant incomes and rising tuition and student debt, the burden of college costs on family and former students is well documented. But these new findings from the National Survey of Student Engagement shows that financial worries are a major source of stress for undergraduates while they're still in school. About three-fifths of the students surveyed reported they often worry about having enough money to cover ordinary costs, and students who spend the most hours at paying jobs are not surprisingly feeling the most financial stress. Among those who work more than 20 hours a week, about three-fifths said that their jobs got in the way of schoolwork. Can someone explain to me, in the richest country in the world, why we can't have free university tuition? Why there has to be tuition for universities at all? I've talked about this before. I mean, if suddenly someone said you're going to have to pay, your family's going to have to pay 10 grand a year for you to go to high school, there'd be riots. There'd be a revolution. So what's the deal? Why do we accept that when you go on in your learning that suddenly it becomes this financial burden to your family and to you? What's the logic here? What's the logic where we have this trillion-dollar military budget to fight who, right? I mean, guys that can barely scrape together 30 troops at one time. I'm not trying to say that's not a threat, but there's something really skewed here. So what I've always advocated, and so many other people, is substantially cut the military budget. For one thing, we just almost eliminate, that's an interesting slip, eliminate our nuclear weapons program. We could easily come to an agreement with Russia. They're anxious to get rid of all this. I mean, the United States nuclear policy that stands in the way of this. Have free education up to what we need so we don't continue to fall behind. All right, let's see. We're going to go to a break pretty quick, but I want to keep all of you folks on the air. Matt and Scott and Dee and Jeff and Rory, you hang on regardless. We're going to take a couple of calls. Now, here's Matt in Garden City. Matt, don't tell me. She did it again? You're on the air.
Yeah, she did it again. I just don't really understand the whole pop culture, I guess, nowadays. I mean, this is a Super Bowl.
Let's tell people what we're talking about. You're saying Beyonce lip-synced again?
Yes, Beyonce lip-synced again. We watched the show, and I mean, I'm at a party with a bunch of 30- and 40-year-old people, and I mean, they're wanting to see guys like Bob Seger and, you know, the Beatles, I mean, what's left of them. You know, guys that we can still see that are still all right and still playing, not Beyonce, who doesn't really do anything, really, for, I mean, maybe some 10, 12-year-old girls that, you know, want to see the choreography of it. But, I mean, we're talking middle-aged people that want to see some good music played at their Super Bowl, and I think they deserve it. And to be honest, I think as the older generations, they should be teaching us that the music that's coming out is just not as well-written, and it's just not as performed as well as it used to be. And
Matt, you sound like our parents.
I'm a 21-year-old guy, and I'll tell you, my uncle taught me at about 18 years old that the music on the radio was not the right thing to hear. So
give me that old-time rock and roll. We could have Bob Seger sing that. Going out with Kid Rock doing a series of concerts. John writes from the other room, trust me, middle-aged men like Beyonce. But I appreciate it, Matt. Thank you very much. Let's see. Here is D in Troy. D, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Pondering a couple issues. State and Fed funds and the choice that states have to make about their funding. I wonder, does that change their protocol at all? Implementations, if I can't get that right exactly, that word.
But you're talking about for health care, for Obama.
For health care funding. And the states, and I'm not claiming to know what the states and the differences with the federals and that are they able to slow down the process? Can they rearrange the rules that will kick in as to everybody being accepted by a certain amount of time?
Now, there's some these Republican governors that are talking about this interposition of states' rights, but, gee, that sounds kind of familiar. And now some of them that at first said they weren't going to do the Medicaid thing now say they are. You know, this is one of these things. I listen to some of my buddies in the industry that do daily shows, and when you do a daily show like when I did, you know everything about everything. I knew so much about when I was doing it a few years ago, that used to drive me nuts. And so now, I just kick back, to the Leonard Skinner line that I often repeat about, I know a little and I can guess the rest. Well, what we're facing here with this Obamacare is this very complicated, very bureaucratic. I mean, anything run by anything other than neighbors is going to be bureaucratic by its very nature. And how it's going to be fleshed out and who it's really going to help, and then we're going to probably find out, wow, rather than helping this little group of people, it's actually turned out to hurt them. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest. I'm not saying it is, but we have no idea how this is going to work out. It looks like there's some wrinkles in this. The IRS just came up with a decision where they're now saying that there might be what they call a donut hole, these people kind of in the middle income that might not qualify for the subsidies and are going to have their insurance rates raised, which is horrible. But what this tells me, Dee, is, and what this is an argument for, is not getting rid of Obamacare, but to have a single-payer national health plan where everybody's in, where we essentially have Medicare for everyone. And you know, seniors, if they want Part B, and they really have to, if they want to go to doctors and all that, so they pay something into it. But that means, you know, whether you're 18 or 88, you got a little card and you pay, I don't know what the Part B is to pay, but say, I think it, I don't know what it is, maybe $100 a month. Someone can tell me about that. $100 a month or $60 a month or something like that. You go to the doctor, give them your card, and they give you the health care. And you say, you need brain surgery, and they say, okay, lay down. You know, you got it. And they don't come back at you and say, we want your house because, you know, we did surgery, on you. So, to me, any problems with Obamacare is really means that, that it's not a government program enough, not that it's too much. All right, I do have to take a break right now, so, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. If anybody can help me, like, with what it costs for a month for a senior under Medicare. So, I mean, put it this way. I'll leave it to you. Someone say, oh, no, that's socialized medicine. Yeah, it is. Socialized medicine. So why do we have socialized medicine for people over 65? Are they all socialists or something like that? So, well, I mean, what about if we had socialized medicine, Medicare for people that were 64 and over or 63? When does it become impermissible, huh? All right, then any other questions, we'll be right back to get your calls. Stay on the line.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend brought to you by MIAT College of Technology. Get licensed to work on jets, helicopters, and wind turbines in 24 months at MIAT College of Technology in Canton. Classes start February 12th. 1-800-NEW-GOAL or MIAT.edu.
WRIF. Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bid online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
At Advance Auto Parts, we know that batteries eventually give up, but we never do. Not when it comes to service. Need a new battery? At Advance, we'll install an autograph battery for you. Free! You shouldn't have to give up any more of your hard-earned cash for great service. There, I said give up, but just to make a point. Give up. At Advance? Ha! Never. Fast, free battery installation, only at Advance Auto Parts. With purchase on most vehicles, see store for details.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
And Jolene is out for the night. And remember, next week, no show at all. I'm going to be traveling. If you want Jolene to do the show, just send an email. And in the subject line, put, Jolene, do the show. She can do it. Let's see. Well, one of the things we just mentioned at the top of the hour, the Super Bowl. Tom writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. What happens when there's a power outage that extends the halftime advertising time by 33 minutes? Who would profit from that? Were there ad brokers auctioning live for the new premium spots? Much more likely a terrorist plot. Be afraid. Not some media scan, heavens. Heaven, not some media scam. Heavens, no. You think that was purposeful? Well, that almost sent San Francisco back. Baltimore was way up, and then that happened. Right. Okay, we're talking about student debt, that how incredibly high it is. And I wonder if any of you are, I'm sure, and any number of you listening are suffering from it. But I wonder, what kind of strategies you have. I've advocated for a long time and cannot understand why there is not a mass student movement demanding either, well, like they have in other countries, an end to debt or a cut, you know, sort of what they call a jubilee, where the debt is relieved. Often that would happen when a king was crowned or a queen was crowned. But there's all, a movement for free tuition, a movement to reduce tuition. I mean, there was huge student strikes in Quebec and California last year, and they did pretty well, particularly in Quebec. So I guess I'm going to owe $80,000, right? Also, Obamacare got an email from someone saying that smokers are going to have to pay a lot more. And it's 1 in 5 Americans smoking. You know, it's only down to 20%. And if we started allowing smoking in bars again, probably 80% of the people are there. There was the Ferndale Blues Festival was the last couple of weekends, and I was thinking, wow. I went to Tony's Sports Bar on Woodward and to hear Albert Young and the Straight Eights, great band. And I remember being in there a number of years ago before the smoking ban, and, oh, man, it was like smoking. If you didn't smoke, you did smoke. You know what I mean? I mean, my clothes down to my T-shirt. And this is the winter, so I've got some stuff on. But anyways, the idea is, they're designed, the penalties that this article says are in Obamacare for smokers that have to pay more, are designed to encourage people to quit. But the fact that older smokers will be paying as much as 3 times the penalty as their younger counterparts, I don't get this. But see, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, we could go nuts trying to figure out what this is all, what all is going to happen with this. So student debt also talking about Obamacare. And you know what? Anything else you'd like to as well. Here's Joe in Shelby Township. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
I'm all right. Yeah. Just got done watching the Super Bowl, and me and my buddies were talking about it, and we were joking around saying it's a conspiracy that Mercedes-Benz actually pulled the plug on the power.
There you go.
Because if you notice, they kept looking at the Mercedes-Benz at the top of the stadium.
Yeah, yeah. But wait, it said you're working and going to school?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, and are you going to leave with a big student debt?
That's the way it's looking. You know, I'm trying to basically finish out my degree, but I want to apply to pharmacy school. And
yeah.
Pharmacy school is easily $100,000.
Oh, yeah, there's something wrong there. Do you hear anything? What campus are you going to school in?
I'm at Wayne State.
Wayne State, yeah. I mean, there's a history. There's a 75-year history of student activism around student issues and other issues there. You would think there'd be somebody that would be saying, look, we can't keep raising tuition. We've got to knock it back. I mean, 40 years ago, and I know, it's a long time, and maybe, glasses of beer were a quarter instead of $6. But, that tuition was like $100 a quarter. for the whole, not an hour, not a credit hour. I mean, for the whole quarter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I can't believe there's not anybody there, because I know there's little pockets of it around the country where people are saying, we got to have free tuition, or we've got to cancel a lot of the student debt, if not all of it, because it is so unfair to start you off in your employment life with this huge debt. I mean, everybody now takes it for granted. Oh, yeah, well, that's what happens. Well,
right.
It didn't used to happen. Didn't happen to me. Didn't happen probably to your parents. They didn't, you know, so I don't know. I do your best to take a look for it. It's kind of hard for me to say, hey, Joe, start a movement. But, yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows who the Rosa Parks among us is, right?
Yeah, and the thing that, you know, makes me think about, you know, I was mentioning, it's a constant thing to be going to work, going to school, trying to find the time to study. You know, I had to cut down in hours, and now I'm not making as much money. And it's you know, people will always say, hey, don't worry about the money. But truthfully, you have to. You have to absolutely worry about it. And, you know, with the inflation of tuition, like, I have a friend, his mother was able to work on campus. She went to Michigan State probably 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She was able to work while going to school and raise a kid. And that's because college was that much cheaper back then.
Yeah. So, you know, the question is, why has it risen? So, because, say, 40 years ago, it was $100 a semester. Now, how much is it a credit hour? I mean, it's more than $100, isn't it?
Oh, I'm taking only 7 credits at Wayne State, but I'm finishing out my last classes at a community college.
Yeah.
My classes alone for 7 credits is a little over $2,500.
Wow.
And that, you know, 7 credits out of potentially what you're earning for a degree is 120 credits, do the math, however many $100 a credit hour. It's so bad that I don't even look at how much it costs a credit hour anymore. I just kind of take the bill as it comes.
Well, you're really stuck. I mean, I hate to use a cliche, but between a rock and a hard place, right? What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And, it's a constant battle, you know, because there's so much involved with it. It's so much money. And I feel part of the fact that it may be so much is due to, you know, you look at the first, for instance, you know, you have to cover the salaries of these professors who are getting paid, you know, and it's a very respectable career to be a professor. But, you know, nowadays to be a professor, it's either master's or doctorate level. So they have to be compensated for this, and they're making a lot of money.
I don't know where if that, though, is where all the costs come, because everything has gone up, say, in the last 40 years from, what does that make it? I can't even do them. Again, 1973. Say things, the price of things has gone up, I don't know, you know, 100-fold or something like that, where wages have gone up 30-fold. So what's really not happened, if there's like this massive inflation because of the cost of doing business, of producing a car or running a university, well, then if, you know, that what you're making an hour, or if your parents are paying for it, that should have gone up substantially. But what's really happened is just that the wealthy class, the 1%, have expanded their wealth enormously, where everyone else's wages and wealth has barely crept up. All right, Joe, good luck on it. I got to move on, but thank you very much. I appreciate you calling. John says Wayne State is about $500 a credit hour. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Rory in Ann Arbor. Rory, hi, you're on the air. Welcome. Hey, oh, right, yeah, I got you up. Rory, you there with me? Boy, that sounds like the crickets. But here, I wanted to hear what he had to say. I wanted to talk about this whole thing about birth control being covered by Obamacare, because these religious people, some of it Catholic-run institutions, hospitals, and what have you, and also some individual employers say, well, it's against my religion. It's against my religion to provide, under Obamacare, birth control to my employees. Well, TS, man. You know, I mean, what? How come they don't get any saved? So you're going to impose your religious values on them? I don't get it. All right, here is Jeff. Jeff, hi, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Oakland Township. Thanks, okay. Peter, for taking my call.
Sure, you're on the air.
I spoke with you last show, I believe, and mentioned the topic about Al Gore with the purchase of Apple stock.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the reason I'm calling tonight was to, I thought being that today was the Super Bowl would be a good point to bring up a book that I have yet to read but is on my shelf called Empire of Illusion by Chris Haynes. Basically, the whole context of the book is talks about how in America society is bombarded with entertainment in the social media and instruments, for example, the smartphones and everything else, to keep us so occupied and complacent that we really are losing touch with what's really going on and not really, I mean, almost keeping us blinded and almost, you know, again, like complacent. Very similar to if you were to look at the Colosseum games during the Roman Empire time.
They are, but yeah, I think that's always what would you call it? Sort of an example of how there was this corrupt empire, and people didn't pay attention to its basic venal nature because they were going to these Colosseum games. Well, I mean, obviously, people didn't go to them every night and every day and what have you. But sure, there most societies, particularly mass societies like ours, operates on a whole set of illusions, and one of them, which is called by some writers and referred to it as the spectacle. And so we are these the mass, that's us, this undifferentiated mass are these passive receptors, and you have this just small group of active communicators. They're the ones that are deciding what you are going to watch and what the styles are going to be and what you're going to consume and what your attitudes are going to be. And there is an increasing illusion of democracy because now there's not just three channels, right? There are three networks. It's so diffuse. And a long time ago, there was a Bruce Springsteen song called 57 Channels. You ever hear that?
Actually, I haven't. No, I haven't.
57 Channels and nothing on. Now it's like 357 channels, and there's a lot on a lot of them. So it can kind of keep you involved in non-human activity, that is, watching. You know the remember from 1984, I hope, you know, Big Brother is watching you? There is a writer, whose name will come to me in a second, a chapter in his book about television called Boxed In, it's the name of the book, it's called Big Brother Is You Watching. In other words, we're our own captors, is that we don't go any further we passively accept that we're all going to be looted of our earning power by this exceptionally high tuition rate that never was before. I mean, people
It really goes back to what you've said numerous times on past shows, that we're not really living in a democracy, but we are in a true plutocracy where, you know, it is obviously run by the original America's 60 Families, which was a book, I believe, written back in the 40s and 50s that actually very ironically can still show to today's times that the original 60 families that came here are the ones that basically own and run the higher institutions, the well-known Ivy Leagues, the Harvard, the Yales, and then also the banking system. So these families are very tight in the sense of how they stay within marriages, within the families, and controlling of the money. If it's a conspiracy thought or not, I'm not sure. It's a very good read, and considering how long ago it was written and that it can still really pertain and apply to today's times, it's pretty impressive.
You may have heard me use this phrase before. It's this country is run by a conspiracy of men who rarely meet, or all of them don't meet together. All organized societies that when we left tribal society, primitive society, and that's not it's not like a critical word if you think about the people that were here before the American or before the European invasion, the native people here. once state society arises, it's always run by, in two of those kind of old-fashioned words, one that you use, a plutocracy. So the rule of the rich. And the original political states arose not to civilize people, not to assist the average person, but to protect them. My phrase, which I've used so many times, to protect the power and the wealth of this small ruling class. And when you have small groups of people running things, it's called an oligarchy. You have and then the larger thing that we'd like to think we live in is a democracy, where the people rule. And you know, we still have the ability to do that. They're just counting on us, getting all upset about gays and guns and God and what have you. And what they, the 1%, really care about is the economy and their control of it. And, I mean, it's not like they're sitting down and they're going to say, I got an idea, let's put all this on television and we'll get these football teams to bash into one another and we'll turn the lights out for half an hour and then we'll almost let one team win. Or even just having a Super Bowl period. It's all sort of self-generated by itself. And in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with it. But if we don't pay attention to those key elements of what affect our lives, if we're actually allowing ourselves to be looted continually of our lives because we work and rather than getting compensated in any reasonable way, extraordinary part of our income and wealth is taken by the 1%, whether it's for college or low wages or, you know, taken from us and rather than spent on our community, spent on preparation for war and in an absolutely absurdly high budget and on and on and on. Whew. Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your call, Jeff. All right. Let me see if we got Rory back. Rory, are you with us? You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for taking my call.
That's okay. Good. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yep. So I was calling to revert to a point you brought up last week, being the healthcare issue in relationship to the, how it offends those of religious background, saying that they don't want to pay for somebody else's sin. And that's the one point that frightens me as far as the entire concept goes. I don't want to trodden on somebody else's religion. If they legitimately feel as though what they're being forced to pay for is a sin, I don't want to make them do that. So couldn't we just, like, make a tax write-off for somebody who are legitimately Christian and doesn't believe in having to pay for birth control?
Well, they did. There's something, this new compromise. I don't know why Obama's always compromising. Well, you know, you come to sort of conclusions, like, for instance, integration. Think about that. Anything from Jackie Robinson in baseball to school integration and what have you, or in a public accommodation. And boy, those Southerners and a lot of Northerners as well, they just thought that was horrible and it was going to disrupt society and it was against their basic values and on and on and on and on like that. But there came to, society came to conclusion that as long as we weren't forcing them to do anything there's nothing in the Constitution say that, you know, you're excluded for having to meet your obligations. I mean, if we said, well, we demand that Roman Catholics practice birth control, even though the vast majority of them do, but if we said the Catholics had to practice birth control, we'd say, whoa, wait a minute, that is some that's way over the top. But I think if we're going to have why should somebody, because they are a nurse at a Catholic hospital that took it because it was a good job and wanted to help people by nursing them, have to pay for their own birth control when someone that's in a Presbyterian hospital or a secular hospital doesn't have to at all because this church, which is, well, I won't say that, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the point that you're making in concept, but I mean, one thing that I truly take pride in as far as the American ideals go is how accepting we are in theory.
Yeah.
The concept being that we accept you no matter what race, what gender, what sexuality, what religion you have. And I kind of feel that through the process of Christianity having such this sort of a tyrannical background, we sort of disregard many of their concerns a lot of the time because of the somewhat brutal history they had. And I don't feel like we would sort of be saying too bad to any other religion if they had a legitimate issue with a tax proposition.
Well, hard to say, to tell you the truth. But I just think that it ought to be something where everyone's included. And that's another maybe in a way, I mean, because you have some legitimacy on what you're saying, Rory. But to me, if that's a failing in Obamacare, the only thing it tells me is that these companies, and I don't know why every one of them isn't for a national health program that the government pays for and administers, they wouldn't have any hand in it whatsoever. All right, I got to run, so thank you very much. Appreciate your call. All right, we'll be getting more of your calls when we come back, and we were talking about how students are saddled with debt. What do you think is suffering the worst under this hard economy? I have that and lots more for you when you come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Which is where you are!
Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Julie's off tonight, and we'll both be gone next week unless she gets a groundswell of demand for her doing the show by herself. You can just send an email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And on the subject line, getting lots of them, too. Jalene, do the show. I don't think she will, but it'll be good for her ego. Anyway, if you go to my website, it's peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerby.com. There is some parodies of that photo released by the White House of President Obama skeet shooting. Why in the world did this guy do this? It's not like he's like up for re-election and he's got to show that, in fact, he's not just a wimpy Democrat that is afraid of guns. There he is just blasting one off, except there is now hundreds of ones that have altered it. I mean, it's pretty funny. You got one, Eat Lead Boner, referring to the Speaker of the House, all right, and just some other ones. They got him in Grand Theft Auto shooting, and another one. Well, you can just go there and check it out. Other very interesting articles as well, I would say, since I put them there. Anyway, at 1 a.m., which is in 1 hour and 30 seconds, there we'll be hearing from Richard Hineberg. Richard Hineberg, he's the guy that wrote this whole thing about where we passed peak oil. In other words, that half the oil that was in the ground is gone and that the rate of acceleration of extraction is getting faster and faster because there's more and more demand for it, and it ain't going to be good. And he works for something called the Post Carbon Institute, and he wrote Energy Overdevelopment. He wrote the introduction. Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. This huge book. I mean, it weighs more than my dog, because I have a very little dog. I used to have a regular-sized dog. Now I got a very little dog. Also, Jay Rosenstein, who wrote this book called everybody's writing a book. This guy, actually, the producer and director of a PBS documentary about, it's called The Lord is Not on Trial Here Today, and it's about this 1945 Supreme Court decision that set the standard for the separation of church and state, which is what the First Amendment begins with to the Constitution, right? All right, yeah, I was going to tell you, who was the hardest hit? You would think maybe young people having to pay back all this debt. Well, it's your parents, really. Young graduates are in debt, out of work, and on their parents' couches. People in their 30s and 40s can't afford to buy homes or have children. This is in the New York Times yesterday. Retirees are earning near zero interest on their savings. In the current listless economy, every generation has a claim to having been the most injured, but the Labor Department's latest job snapshots and other recent data reports present a strong case for crowning baby boomers as the greatest victims of the recession and its grim aftermath. These Americans in their 50s and early 60s, those near retirement age but who do not yet have access to Medicare and Social Security, have lost the most earnings of any age group, with their household incomes 10% below what they made when the recovery began 3 years ago. Their retirement savings and home values fell sharply at the worst possible time, just before they needed to cash out. They're often supporting both aging parents and unemployed young adult children, earning them the nickname Generation Squeeze. Wow, nobody likes to be squeezed. New research suggests that they may die sooner because their health, income security, and mental well-being were battered by recession at a crucial time in their lives. A recent study by economists at Wellesley College found that people who lost their jobs in the last few years before becoming eligible for Social Security lost up to 3 years from their life expectancy, largely because they no longer had access to affordable health care. For instance, Susan Zimmerman, 62 years old, she said, "If I break my wrist, I lose my house." Well, you got it. These people really screwed up, didn't? Oh, no. Oh, it wasn't them, was it? It was all the rich people. They got even richer since all this went down. So all these people were screwed. Millions of people screwed. Now, if you're a young person, you're maybe talking about your parents in their late 50s and early 60s. And they're sticking it to you, if I'm talking to the young people again, by this extraordinarily, ridiculously high tuition that's going to saddle you with debt as soon as you leave college. And they're screwing your parents, taking 3 years off their lives. We shouldn't like these people at the top. They're not doing anything for us. They're only doing it for themselves. Don't you think? 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Let's get another call here. Here's Paul. Paul's in Chesterfield. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Nothing much. Can you turn your radio completely off?
Oh, yeah. Hold on a second.
Yeah. All right. Because we've got one.
I think we're on the wrong topic, though. Well, I was calling about the Coke commercial that you were speaking about earlier.
Yeah, right at the beginning when these Arab American groups were saying that it was disparaging of Arabs because they show this Arab on a camel lost in the what was it? What did they say? Lost in the dust? What's the word? Yeah. What's the word? What's the phrase?
I'm sorry?
What's the phrase? Lost in the dust? That's not right. Left in the dust. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, because on this race against showgirls and cowboys and what is it? Bikers? Is that the third group?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Some outlaw bikers.
It's like a Mad Max group or something.
Yeah, that's
like that.
Right. That's right. Mad Maxers. Yeah. Okay. And so these Arab American groups were saying this. Look, they're just showing like the camel jockey that can't compete. What do you think? They said it was racist and stereotypical of Arabs.
Well, I mean, I can understand why they might think that, but I think that's ridiculous. I mean, why don't we just say it's racist and stereotypical against, you know, women in pink buses, too? You know what I mean? Like, what, were they the ones who were going to win? It's said to be continued.
Yeah, aren't we supposed to vote or something like that?
Yeah, I guess that's the idea, but I think they're counting themselves out before they even had a chance, you know. Who's to say that the camel jockeys won't make it all the way there or the whatever they're supposed to be, you know?
Yeah, by the way, I should say that Paul, using that phrase, which is often considered derogatory, is what one of the Arab American groups said, that they're portrayed as camel jockeys. Well, that's interesting. You know, wouldn't that be something if, in fact, the guy on the camel began to win? Because certainly the chorus girls on the bus and the Mad Maxers aren't very pleasant people. If you can vote, maybe we all ought to vote for the guy on the camel. All right. Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate it. Any more thoughts on that? Let me know. Here's Paul in Plymouth. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for calling.
Hey, I wanted to make a comparison. A number of years ago, you were talking about housing values, and I want to compare that to student tuitions today.
Sure.
And I mentioned a number of years ago, like I said, when I was on, was about resetting the system, whether that pertained to our property values, which are overly inflated. You know, the cost of our houses far surpasses their replacement costs. And we're all just being soaked. Our governments have gotten bigger. Our municipalities have grown. They've hired more people. They get bigger salaries. It's the same thing with our education system for our kids. These colleges raise up the tuitions. The teachers are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have tenure. Not all of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a little high.
But they do make that. And it's maybe time to reset the system. These kids need to have an education for $100 credit hour, not $500 or less than $100. And I don't think that these teachers, I think everyone's making a little bit too much. And I'm not talking about the union guys or the people down that are making the people who work in this country. People got to bring the wages back to normal. It's just been all over inflated. And,
wages are dropping and dropping and dropping. I mean, it's,
but not for the people in those colleges. They're not taking any cuts.
You mean like
anybody with tenure?
The college professors you're talking about?
Yeah, and these colleges have more endowments. Hey, maybe they should just forgive all this debt because it's only fair that these next generation that got the education, that worked hard, and not that I should say they're going to have to pay it back, but shouldn't have to pay it back, but I think they should have an opportunity to prosper, especially in this type of environment.
What do you think about having free college education? I mean, we're the wealthiest country in the world. I don't understand why we can't afford everything. We can. Yeah, all the money is here. It's just being allocated and distributed in a way that doesn't work well for everybody and getting worse.
If that could be done, I'm all for it. It just seems like we've gotten grown and grown and grown. I mean, I see it in my own municipality here.
Yeah.
That is growing out. Even our school systems got out of control. Building and the salaries. And we're shrinking. You know, and what do we do? Can I mention something real quick on a commercial?
Sure.
Paul Harvey was in one of those commercials. His voiceover, the legendary.
Come
voice
on.
Paul Harvey.
I didn't see him all.
With the, he did the farm 2-minute, Dodge commercial for, America's Farmers. And, I gotta say, that was to hear Harvey's voice in there, and they gave him a little credit on there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that was cool, along with the Budweiser commercial.
Well, Paul, good day.
Thanks, man.
That's what Paul Harvey used to say. Paul maybe liked him better than I did. He was quite a right winger. Here, this article that's on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. I couldn't find it earlier. It was on my own website. U.S. to become a second-rate power by David Swanson. Doesn't mean we're not going to have a real strong military or anything like that, but get this. I'm not reading through it well. It says, because he's referring to something before it. For most of us in this country, coming in second would be highly welcome. You know, we used to say number one, number one. Jalene and I kid about that sometimes. But David Swanson says, for most of us in this country, coming in second would be highly welcome, a real improvement over the current state of affairs, considering that among the nations of the world we are now in, we are in 22nd place when it comes to keeping our people out of long-term unemployment. We're 26th place in school performance and the same in literacy. It means there's 25 other countries that have more better literacy than we do school performance. We're in 35th place in keeping our fellow citizens above the poverty line. We're 37th place in providing health care. In other words, there's 36 other countries that provide better health care, have a better health care system. He said in providing health care. The health care, if you got the do-re-mi, you're doing great. Great place to be. Now, this is horrible. We're 48th in infant mortality, which means keeping babies alive until their first birthday. We're 50th place for life expectancy at birth. In other words, once you get beyond infant mortality, you've got a pretty good chance to live, you know, quite a ways. But we're 50th place. Now, how about this? The overall equality of income distribution, we're 91st. We're 116th place in the share of income held by the poorest 10%. I mean, you add all of that up to, and what do you get? I mean, you get a country that is not living up to its ideals, as far as I'm concerned. You tell me, though. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here's Rick in Farmington Hills. Rick, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Yeah, I was just calling about that commercial, man. The only race was the race that was being run.
What do you mean?
Well,
we're talking about the Coke commercial that was on the Super Bowl. I was just telling everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, the only race was the race being won. For anybody to think that there was something racial going on here, it was a mirage in the desert. Did anybody see the wavering of the film?
Way
mirages go. So I mean, God, people ought to stop bringing up race all the time. Besides, it comes along with the territory.
Well,
so give it up.
Yeah, don't you think? I just think Coke. I mean, just think how many times we're mentioning Coca-Cola. I mean, if they had to pay for that on WRIF, we'd be billing them a lot. So
that was man.
But I saw it on the internet. I didn't see it at the Super Bowl. But is there some way you vote for?
No, I think it was it just started out. You saw the camels, then you saw the Coke. So obviously, if you any kind of a thinking person, oh, that's a mirage.
Right. Right.
So, and then for somebody of Arab ethnicity to call and say, oh, they're kicking us around. Come on, please. You're in America.
Yeah, I know. But a lot of groups don't get the same respect that other people do. But thank you, Rick. I appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Scott. Scott's in Westland. Scott, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Pete. Well, I wanted to talk about gun control. And I wanted to talk about, three things, basically. I have one main point and two sort of anecdotal ones. And I know that you're a part-time newspaper editor, so you're always looking for a headline. So the headline for my main point is one round at a time. In my opinion, the difference between a semi-automatic gun that's designed for hunting and one that's designed for combat is just generally the speed with which it can be reloaded.
Right.
Now, there are a lot of semi-automatic guns, rifles, designed for hunting, which are semi-automatic, but, you know, they have like an internal tubular magazine, and you can only reload them by, pushing one round in them at a time. A combat weapon has a detachable box magazine. And now I support, the old assault weapons bill and the new one they're talking about, but I think limiting, the number of rounds to 10, in a magazine doesn't really matter much as long as the gun can still accept a detachable box magazine, because there are so many of these, 20 and 30 and whatever, large capacity magazines on the market. The second thing I wanted to point out was just the semantics of the Second Amendment. Remember the phrase is well-regulated militia.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that phrase, well-regulated, justify quite a few regulations like universal registration,
Well, yeah, also you would think that the whole idea of regulation, who puts in regulations? Government. It's not it was ill-written, and it had to do with so much compromise, of course. All right, Scott, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I want to report on a brief conversation I had with a guy who was taking me to the VA hospital. He was a contract driver for the VA since my car is down.
Yeah.
And somehow we got on the subject of Obamacare, because we were talking about crime. And we were talking about this expansion of mental health that the NRA is calling for.
Yeah.
And he was saying, well, that's going to take a bite out of the country, talking about Obamacare. I said, but wait a minute. Now, the NRA is calling for this.
Right.
And they also claim they want smaller government. But at the same time, they're also calling for these background checks you were just talking about.
Well, did you see the Super Bowl tonight?
Yes, I did.
Well, like I was telling people, I was mostly involved in preparing for the show. So, and it looked like Baltimore was going to run away with it. So I kind of tuned out and just paid attention to what I had to do. But I believe there was an ad which showed the head of the NRA, now Wayne LaPierre, about 13 years ago when they were talking about the instant universal background checks, and now he's talking about it some, you know, Big Brother state. I mean, they've completely changed their view on it.
Well, that's the you know, I probably missed that commercial, but, you know, I told this guy, you know, there is a lot that the conservatives, and you heard me say this, actually don't want to pay for. They really don't want to pay for mental health. They don't want to pay for the war injured. They don't even want to pay for natural catastrophes.
Yeah. No, they don't.
You know?
Well, it's every man for himself and God against all. That's their view, I guess.
Well, you know, he asked me where I got all of this from, and I said, well, you know, I listen to your show.
All right.
I listen to NPR and I watch PBS.
Yeah.
Now, that leads me, PBS leads me into something I saw last night on the program, Need to Know. This has to do with schools and jobs. First of all, and I agree with them, a four-year college is not for everybody. And expense is much too great, you know, for a lot of people.
Sure.
And they may not have a skill that they can graduate and go into when you've got plenty of people who've already graduated and still can't get a job. Then there's a skills gap that employers report. But for some reason, for people who want small government, they actually want the government to do the training instead of taking these people on themselves and training them. Because the only place you can learn a lot of things is on the job. And they pointed, for instance, to the closing of the Philadelphia shipyard a few years ago and how you lost all of those people who were skilled in welding and pipe fitting and things. But now you got Southern shipyards with these billion-dollar contracts from the feds who say they can't get enough skilled labor, you know. So why are we pitting state against state in this country when so much of this should be handled at the federal level?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that the federal government does through its taxation is to transfer a section of the money we make weekly and then distribute it. The problem is that it's distributed really badly and doesn't work for the majority of people. It works for the defense contractors, so they're spending like $1 trillion a year where we probably could get by with about 20% of that. So we'd have $800 billion left to deal with everything from roads and schools to free tuition. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Fred. I appreciate your call. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Steve in Ann Arbor. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to comment. It sounds like a slight sidetrack, but I wanted to talk about single mothers.
Sure. Well, no. Listen, I'm more ADD than probably most of you, so go right ahead.
I respect that. I personally have a involved issue with this. I was raised by a single mother, and she wasn't in the home. She was forced to work all the time, and because my father and her didn't get along, they were separated. And the reality is that there is this involvement within the judicial system where they control kind of how that unfolds, whether it be, you know, through child support, parenting time, what have you. It leads to the parents having to be out of the home and eventually, you know, forcing them to have to pay for a caretaker or to push them into, you know, schooling programs that will eventually raise those kids. And what I'm seeing is that the children are being, you know, overwhelmingly distracted by entertainment and this foolish ideal that they're going to be making millions, you know, by the time that they graduate college. Well, the reality is they're graduating with a mortgage.
Yeah.
And as sad as that is, these single mothers are in such a position where they're really not taking care of themselves. And, you know, that leads me into the real topic that I want to talk about, and that's healthcare.
Sure.
We have improper diagnosis in this country that is just overwhelming. And you see people taking medications by the handful that are just counterproductive and causing your immune system to just shut down and not work at its full potential. You know, poor food supply, you know, food deserts within certain communities, you name it, it amplifies the problem.
I agree. It does. It I mean, I know people that are that take 12 different medications. And people say, well, I'm very sick, and this has been prescribed. But at some point, you can't put all of those things that act on your body simultaneously and not have some bad effects. I may be speaking outside of my realm because who knows? I mean, any number of people may be taking that medication because it keeps them alive. But this is a heavily over-medicated society. The other thing is, too, is that a medication is the same dose is prescribed for somebody who's 6'2" and weighs 225 and for a little person that weighs 105 pounds and 5 feet tall. It doesn't make a bit of sense. All right. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. We have some open lines for you if you'd like to grab them. 313-298-WRIF. One of the things we were talking about under Obamacare is there's a great cry and hue by religious organizations, religions themselves, like the Catholic Church, and religious individuals who are employers, all who are employers, who say they don't want to be forced under Obamacare to provide birth control for their employees, and I don't know if it's men and women or just women, but at least for women, maybe for men as well. And now, again, Obama has compromised, as he always does. When does the right wing ever make a compromise? Ever. They never make any compromise. I mean, they back down once in a while, like they did over this over the debt ceiling, but they never compromise, ever. Obama ought to take a leaf from their book. But they're saying that they can't be forced to provide a kind of health care that contradicts their religious value. Ted from Chesterfield writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, if Christian hospitals want to have a say about a taxpayer service, they should pay taxes because churches are exempt from paying taxes. Let's see. Here's another thing. I hadn't read this in advance. Usually Jalene does this. Terry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The religious employer can't prove his or her God disapproves of birth control. There is no evidence. Are we going to allow religious landlords to deny unmarried couples a roof over their head? Some couples have civil ceremonies without a mention of God or religion. Would we condone employers discriminating against opposing religions or atheists? Give the religious an inch and they take a mile. Well, they have a mile, actually. So we'll do this. Okay, let me see. Wanted to tell you about a couple of other things while you were calling. 313-298-WRIF. It was a bad week for both, people that support gun control and people that oppose it. This absolutely incredible story about the death of ex-Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, who the Pentagon deemed as among its deadliest American snipers, was in Iraq for four tours of duty, killed 160 people with a sniper's rifle. And I thought, man, that is really creepy. Yeah, they're just kind of just plugging people. They don't even realize they're in battle. But I was thinking, wow, what's any different than dropping a bomb or, I suppose, just shooting at people? But it's, I don't know, he's 38 years old, and he and a friend brought a troubled veteran to a shooting range, the guy had with a semi-automatic pistol shot to death Chris Kyle and also Chad Littlefield. Chris Kyle had written a book called American Sniper. Very bizarre. Also, there's that gunman who killed the bus driver in Arkansas and said he wanted two children, wound up taking one, and there's still this hostage situation where he has this five-year-old in this underground bunker. He's heavily armed, and apparently he says he's taking care of the kid. No one knows what he wants. They're keeping these negotiations secret. On the other hand, so people are saying, yeah, we have to control our guns. We have to control our guns. But these strict gun laws in Chicago don't seem to be doing much there. Last year there was 500 gun deaths there. But there's not a single gun shop in the entire city because they are outlawed. Handguns were banned in Chicago for decades until 2010 when the United States Supreme Court ruled that it went too far. And despite a continued legal fight, Illinois remains the only state in the nation with no provision to let private citizens carry guns in public. And yet Chicago, with a city with no civilian gun ranges and bans on both assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, finds itself laboring to stem a flood of gun violence that contributed to more than 500 homicides last year and at least 40 killings already in 2013, including the fatal shooting of that 15-year-old girl that was that played in a band at President Obama's inauguration. But one thing is interesting. So the police say they are discovering far more guns on the streets of Chicago than in the nation's two most populous cities, Los Angeles and New York. They seized 7,400 guns here in crimes or unpermitted uses last year, compared with less than half that in New York City, and have confiscated 574 guns just since January 1st, 124 of them last week. And these are guns from criminals, right? More than a quarter of the firearms seized on the street here by Chicago Police Department over the past 5 years were bought just outside the city limits in Cook County suburbs, according to an analysis by the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Others came from stores around Illinois and from other states like Indiana, less than an hour's drive away. Since 2008, more than 1,300 of the confiscated guns, the analysis shows, were bought from just one store, Chuck's Gun Shop in Riverdale, Illinois, within a few miles of the Chicago city limits. So what does that tell us? So here, Chuck has got this legal shop. No problem. You know, he's following the law. And yet his guns wind up killing people, being in the hands of people that are sticking us up, on and on like that. But like I say, so it doesn't appear, well, I mean, if you allow this loose selling of guns just a little bit outside of a place where you're not supposed to have guns, everybody winds up with them. One of the things that's happened is that there's been a drop in the percentage of gun deaths by suicide among veterans. Can you believe this, that veterans are killing themselves at 22 a day? Actually, it was in 2010, the most recent year available. I mean, this is extraordinary. They're up slightly in recent years. They account for a shrinking percentage of the nation's total number of suicides as a result of steadily rising numbers of suicides in the general population. What is happening to us, people? What is happening to us? It was up 22%, the suicides among veterans, from 2007 when the daily number was 18, but it is only 10% higher than in 1999. In the same 12-year period, the total number of suicides in the country rose steadily to an estimated 105 a day in 2010, up from 80 in 1999, a 31% increase. Well, gee, what happened in between there? Oh, yeah, that's right. Bush wrecked the economy. Remember him? Remember George W. Bush? Remember that guy? You don't hear about him anymore. Yeah, he wrecked the economy, gave everything away to his rich buddies, screwed up everything, got us in two wars that thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people have died in. And when you start counting those people we went over to save from Saddam Hussein, right? All right, here in South Carolina is Lib. Hey, Lib, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. A couple callers ago, the guy opened my eyes. He was talking about the detachable magazines on assault rifles.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm a Desert Storm veteran.
Okay.
I used to walk around with 120 rounds of M16.
Okay.
On my body. It's easy. Just either change the assault rifles, where you click the magazine in, or the design of the magazine itself, so that anything new after we pass a sensible law, that there's an extra groove either on the rifle or on the magazine, so that the 30-round magazines will no longer fit.
Huh. That's interesting. Technology, yeah.
Yeah. The war story. The hurricane that hit Houston after Katrina.
Right.
There were traffic jams from hell. My brother was sitting in one for 5 hours.
Wow.
He got 30 miles. He said, screw this, turned around and went home and weathered the storm very well. The National Guard sent out military trucks with gasoline and started filling up people on the highways. The problem is, guess what? Military gas tanks are bigger. The filling hole is bigger than a passenger car.
Oh.
You remember when we changed over from leaded gasoline
sure.
to unleaded gasoline?
Sure. Yeah.
The size of the pump nozzle was different, and those for military is different. And they ran into a big problem. They couldn't fill up the cars.
Wow. I don't know. Is this common now? My latest car doesn't even have a gas cap. Capless gas. It's hard for me to say. Capless gas tank. All right, Lib, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for listening way down south. All right, be right back. And did any of you hear how the Republicans, they're really trying to hold Democrats' feet to the fire? They say the Senate has not passed a budget in, I don't know, a number of years. And they say that until they're going to introduce a bill that says until the Senate passes a budget that they are going to withhold the pay. And this has got to go through the Senate as well, of course. They're going to withhold the pay from the Senate. Is this going to hurt these guys? I'll tell you when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Now, breathe that.
is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Angeline's off for the evening, and both of us will be off next week unless she decides to do it. If you'd like her to be on the program, well, in my absence, I'll be traveling. Send an email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just put in the subject line, Jolene, do the show, or something like that. We were talking about where our money goes. Where a lot of our money goes is for, with decreased wages and decreased benefits, and $1 trillion of it a year is spent on an unnecessary war budget. And Stuart writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Actually, it's an article by Walter Pincus in the Washington Post. Says excess profits tax on defense contractors during wartime is long overdue. And I, you know, it's a long article, and I haven't had a chance to read through it. But he says, since 2002, profits of the five largest U.S.-based defense contractors have increased by a whopping 450%. Profits of the five rose from $2.4 billion in 2002, adjusted for inflation, to $13.4 billion in 2011. Now, I think I was going to, I can't read this whole thing here, but I think during World War II, there was an excess profits tax. But there ought to be an excess profits tax on all these corporations that are gouging us, like ExxonMobil and all that. Well, the prices are going up again, right? The gasoline prices. 313-298-WRIF. And remember I was saying before the break, these representatives, these Republicans in the House of Representatives that have managed to reconfigure the congressional districts so that even though they lost the vote for House, for congressional representatives across the country. In other words, if you took all 435 districts, added up the vote total, the Democrats got 1.5 million votes more. And I was hesitating because I was looking to see, I can't even remember exactly what, how they wound up apportioning themselves, the Republicans, a much greater number of seats in the House of Representatives. Not just, you know, a few more, but a lot more. So one of the things they're saying, they're always talking about sound financial principles. I mean, they're, never mind. But one of the things they said was that that Congress will not get its paycheck until it passes a budget. And they have this this little slogan, no budget, no pay. It's a proposal which the House passed last week, actually a couple weeks ago now, when it voted to temporarily extend the debt limit. It's also a basic reality. Many of those who support the concept are so wealthy that their congressional paychecks represents a little more than a rounding error. You know what that means? You know, like some of these billionaires, when they'll give, trying to think who was it. Oh, yeah, it was the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, who gave, $235 million, I think it was, to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And and he's worth like, I don't know, what is it, $10 billion, $11 billion? And if you round it off, he's still worth $10 or $11 billion. But anyway, so here are the guys that are putting this together. This Michigan Republican, Representative Dave Camp, and he's the guy that led the charge on the measure in the House. He has a net worth up to almost $10 million, according to analysis of his most recent financial disclosure by the Center for Responsive Politics. And it's not exactly a fortune befitting a Rockefeller or a Kennedy, but it could cushion any discomfort he might feel from missing a few paydays. Many of the other lawmakers who have championed no budget, no pay, both Republicans and Democrats, are similarly wealthy. I don't know what caught me there. Congress, for all its Democratic trappings, have long been richer than a typical collection of 535 Americans. But the gap between the financial standing of members and the population as a whole, guess what, has appeared to have grown in recent decades. as many ordinary Americans, that's almost all of you, and I, although some of you think us in radio just make this fortune, is me as well, have struggled to get by in recent years. Members of Congress were largely insulated from the economic turndown based on their net worth. And remember, they are the 1%. The median net worth of American households, that's everybody that's providing income there, is $66,740. Okay? So that, yeah, some of you are going, wow, man, I wish me and my wife were making that, right? But the 535 members of Congress, the net worth, the median net worth for the 535 members of Congress is, you ready for this? $966,000. Almost $1 million. Congressional lawmakers earn at least $174,000 a year, so if that went away, I mean, why should we even pay these guys? I mean, if their median net worth is $1 million, and you know, that looks like the Dave Camp, the Republican from Michigan, making almost $10 million, why wouldn't they turn back all their money? Why wouldn't they say, okay, let's give it to, I don't know who, the Boy Scouts? Oh, no, I forgot they discriminate against gays. But Planned Parenthood, oh, no, that's right. They do abortions. Must be somewhere they give it to. But the Democratic co-sponsor of the No Budget, No Pay bill in the Senate is Joe Manchin III of West Virginia. He's worth almost $11 million. The other Senate co-sponsor, Dean Heller, Republican of Nevada, is worth less but is doing just fine, worth as much as $3.5 million. And the Senate may pass the measure. But I don't know, that was a week ago or so. I don't know if it ever got passed. But how silly. I mean, for one thing, they can't do it. The 27th Amendment to the Constitution says that lawmakers cannot vary their compensation in a single Congress. In other words, they don't want people saying, okay, we're going to give ourselves $1 million. Let's see. Here is Stephen in Monroe, the home of Fermi 2, hopefully not Fermi 3. Go ahead, Stephen. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. How are you?
Doing well. I was curious, what's your problem with the United States being a free republic versus what you wanted to be a democracy?
Not quite sure what you mean.
Well, the United States of America is a free republic. We're not a democracy. Everyone keeps calling democracy democracy all the time, but 99% of the people cannot control one of the people's choice, 1% of the person's choice. And you want to go here and bum rush everybody with 51% mob rule and saying that's acceptable.
Wait a minute. Do you accept that by gaining control of these state houses that these Republicans can twist all these districts so that people in Grosse Pointe through Detroit up through Royal Oak and into Pontiac just so they can get undemocratically more representatives for the Republicans? Come on. What? Democracy is the form of which the republic operates. I don't know why you have to put the adjective in there. Democracy is elections, and they have been. I mean, the Republicans are a minority party. They're going to be history real quickly, and the only way they even are in office at all is through chicanery. Come on.
We're not talking. We're talking a free republic. And
why do you keep using the word free republic as opposed to a republic?
If I agree that you don't disagree with me and 10 people say I'm wrong, but I'm my own individual, you should not be telling me I can do this or I can't do this.
Well, wait a minute. I'm telling you, you can't murder anybody. You can't cheat people. You can't beat up your kids.
Murder, steal. Exactly. But after that, this is my life. This is what I want to do. I have unalienable rights. There's no reason why you should have any control of whatever I say.
Over you? Of course not. Why? Yeah, I mean, that's in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Why would I want to stop you from saying it? I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, this is what your radio show is about, and I don't even understand, you know, what you're talking about. That's why I'm
calling. Well, maybe we ought to hang up. If I can't understand what you're talking about and you can't understand what I'm talking about, we might as well be one of us talking Serbo-Croatian.
Oh, you're just spewing rhetoric to the rest of your listeners.
Well, wait a minute. I'm spewing rhetoric and you're talking common sense, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's good. You know, it might seem to me that you're spewing rhetoric and I'm talking common sense. So where do we go from there?
I agree me, we live in a free republic.
I don't even know what you mean by a free republic as opposed to a republic. That's what the Pledge of Allegiance says. It says, to the republic for which it stands. It doesn't say to a free republic for which it stands. Why do you keep putting this word free in front of it?
We live in a free republic.
Okay, man. I don't know. You're off on some weird ideological thing that I can't understand. So I can't understand you. You can't understand me. And I'll bet you if we took a poll, more people that are listening would understand me than would understand you. So goodbye. And in terms of people's freedom of speech, you say, whoa, I just cut the guy off. But I don't get it. I mean, I do. I mean, this is some weird ideological, this free republic thing is just kind of, it's been around for a while with the far right wing, but I don't get why the republic is the form of government and the form of choosing representatives is democracy. It's being distorted by the way, for instance, the House of Representatives is being chosen now because the Republicans have skewed the districts so they can control the outcome of the elections. So, but I don't get why you would keep saying a free republic as opposed to an unfree republic. I mean, usually you want to, there's freedom and there's unfreedom. So, I mean, where is there an unfree republic? I don't get it. I don't get it one little bit. All right. I meant to bring a couple more things up. Someone explain that to me. No, never mind. Never mind. I don't know. I mean, imagine that. He's saying, I tell him I can't understand what he's saying. He's saying, I can't understand what I'm saying. Not much basis for a dialogue, is all right. Here's one thing. I could have asked him about this, I suppose. The United States is weighing putting bases for spy drones in North Africa. And you talk about where our money's going. Talk about the right. Talk about the libertarians, of which this guy might be. I'm not trying to saddle anybody with this guy. But Ron Paul, remember? He was saying, got to bring all the bases back. Obama, just like presidents before him, they want to expand the military presence throughout the throughout the world. So the United States military is preparing to establish a drone base in Northwest Africa so it can increase surveillance missions on local affiliates of Al-Qaeda and other Islamist extremist groups that American and other Western officials say pose a growing menace to the region. It doesn't sound good. I mean, these guys are pretty awful to the areas that they dominate and could represent a threat to us as well. So you're saying, well, maybe this is a good thing. For now, officials say they envision flying only unarmed surveillance drones from the base, though they have not ruled out conducting missile strikes at some point if the threat worsens. Well, what do you think? Think there's any chance there are going to be drones? A new drone base in Northwest Africa would join a constellation of small airstrips in recent years on the continent, including in Ethiopia for surveillance missions flown by drones or turboprop planes designed to look like civilian aircraft. If the base is approved, the most likely location for it would be in Niger, a largely desert nation on the eastern border of Mali. The American military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, is also discussing options for the base with other countries in the region. Now, this, think about this, the Africa Command. I think I may have mentioned this the other week. We are the only country in the world that has any bases outside of its own nation. I think maybe Russia had this little teeny naval base in Syria. But China doesn't have any. Who are the big countries? I don't know. We just don't. They're not there. Or if they are, there's only a couple of them. Maybe they had a couple they didn't tell me about. These drone strikes, which now we can say, okay, they protect us against Al-Qaeda. Actually, it is the other way around. It probably is making us less safe. Because the more we are in the face of these people, the more they see us as an enemy to be attacked. And now the drone strikes, which has killed thousands of innocent people in Asia and in Africa, like in Yemen, has now become a top propaganda issue for Al-Qaeda. So it's going to have the opposite effect, and it also is going to cost us billions and billions of dollars. All right, let's take what may be, well, we got maybe time for another couple of calls. 313-298-WRIF. It's Jack in Trenton. Jack, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? I just didn't know if anybody heard about that National Geographic study that just came out about the parasite that can lodge itself in humans inside their brain, and they get it from cats, specifically mostly feral cats, but if you let your domesticated cat out, and it's basically, it's an asexual parasite where it goes from cat, and they get it from rats or mice, and you can pick it up maybe from the dust of kitty litter or water, and once it gets in the humans, it'll stay in there. It doesn't like threaten the life of a human, but it'll cause anything from autism, schizophrenia to bipolarism. And I just wanted to know if you heard about the National Geographic study that came out. And the government's been trying to hide it for a long time, and finally a doctor let the cat out of the bag, no pun intended. Just want to know if you heard anything about that.
No, I didn't. I actually thought I saw feral cats. I thought you were going to talk about, there's this another study just released that said that both domestic and feral cats kill like over a billion birds a year, and 13 billion. I don't know. How do they count this? How do they make these estimates? 13 billion rodents, which I suppose some of them are good. I mean, given that we have mice in our house, I wouldn't mind having our cats back. But they do great damage, and people feeding feral cats, for instance, is bad news. And as usual, we ought to have all our pets neutered. And cats, I don't know. I mean, one of the things that people used to do is put a bell around the cat's neck, the idea being that the bird would hear them coming. But these cats, we had cats for years. They were so cunning. I used to watch them. They would just stay stock still until they pounced, and then that was it. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'll take a look at that. Yeah, these drones, it's one of these things where they take out people. We're always talking. We're told that they take out the correct person. Of course, we don't know. And Obama has now permitted the killing of U.S. citizens without trial. So this is not the way. Sorry for this guy Stephen, but this is not the way democracy works. Not the way a free republic works either. Well, let's do this. I may take one more call if we can get it up. Here we can. We'll just take this one more, and then we'll go to these interviews that I've done. Did I even mention them? I think that I did. Man, it is hard. Oh, yeah, here we are. Hard to hear without Jolene. Yeah, it's going to be, first off, it's going to be Richard Heinberg, famous for his theory of peak oil, meaning, man, we are starting to drain the last of it all. First bit took about a billion years, and thinks we might be draining it in not so long from now. And he's got this huge tabletop book that we'll talk about. And also, the producer and director of a PBS documentary called The Lord is Not on Trial here today, which talks about the Supreme Court decision. It was a recent documentary that talks about the Supreme Court decision that set the standard for the very important separation of church and state. You go to my website, by the way, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and you saw that ridiculous photograph of Obama skeet shooting. And the reason it's ridiculous is, why in the hell did he do it? And, I mean, wouldn't he have thought that it was going to be the subject of a tremendous parody? Well, I have three photographs from it, and we'll see. Maybe Debbie will put it on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/nightcall as well. All right, let's go back and get a quick one with Ned in Roseville. Hey, Ned, you're on the air. Welcome. Hey, Ned, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. I've been listening to your show for, like, years.
Yeah.
And I noticed tonight that you didn't have your co-host, Jolene.
Jolene, yeah.
Yep. And she's very anti-gun, I noticed. And
yeah.
I wanted to say this one thing. My sister is in the radio community, and she makes six digits at least.
She what? So it makes six figures, yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
Good.
So she doesn't know what it's like to go to a gas station and look around and notice who's going to rob you. Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up in the D. I still work in the D. And it's bad. But I think everybody should be able to carry a gun, okay, and be responsible.
That's well, most everybody can now, so there's nothing that's in any of these laws that would prohibit anybody from, and there's nothing in any of these bills that would confiscate these millions of assault rifles that already exist, and that's not an issue. The only thing that's an issue is, and people ought to get their heads around it, that the idea that that they somehow need a weapon in the comings and going of most of us in this society, I think is really, wrong-headed. I mean, I go everywhere around the city of Detroit, in Detroit. It never occurred to me that I would need to carry a gun. And we know statistically that homes with guns and people with guns have a much, much higher chance of hurting themselves or hurting their family than they do ever protecting themselves. And I gotta go. Sorry to leave it on that, Ned, but thank you for calling. Stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll enjoy them. And remember, both Jalene and I will be off next week unless we can convince her to do it. Just write calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Say, and in the subject line, it's all you need to put. Jalene, do the show. Stay tuned.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
FM WRIF HD 1 Detroit.
Free tickets for Tindle Box February 8th. And maybe the chance to meet the band backstage. Listen and win from 101 The Riff.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I think if you've listened to this broadcast for any number of, well, years, you know the importance I put on the concerns about the environment, its degradation to the point where many people feel that we are close to the point of no return to wrecking the planet. I know that sounds kind of Chicken Little-ish and catastrophism and all that, but, you know, read some of this stuff. In fact, let's look at a book, a phenomenal book that has come my way. It's called Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And that's the theme, and the essays that are in it support the contention that we're in trouble, as not just as a species, but as a planet. The Energy is edited by Tom Butler and George Werthner, and features the writing of more than 30 leading thinkers on energy, society, and ecology. One of its features that I think is compelling is the size of it. I have a 7-pound dog, and this book weighs more than that. It's what they call a coffee table book, but it, in many ways, I think that the description belies the importance of this. There's an introduction by Richard Heinberg, who's been a guest on this show a couple of times at least. I was trying to remember. Probably the book he's best known for is The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, where he raises the concept of peak oil, that we've already peaked, that we're starting to run out, and what stems from that. One of the words in the title, of course, is war, and we start seeing resource wars. His latest book is The End of Growth, and that Richard Heinberg is an American journalist and educator. He writes extensively on energy, economic, and ecological issues, and as I said, probably maybe most importantly, oil depletion. He's written 10 books, and he's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, and we're reaching him there. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's good to be with you again.
And remind us where the Post Carbon Institute is.
We're in Santa Rosa, California, about an hour north of San Francisco.
Tell me about this book. It is huge, and it is a cooperation between your institute, the Post Carbon Institute, and also the Earth,
Foundation for Deep Ecology,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Tell us just in, and you can kind of combine these answers, deep ecology, what the meaning of that and how it relates to this new book, Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth.
Well, deep ecology is an idea that goes back to the 1980s. It's the notion that we should be looking at ecological issues not just from the standpoint of the usefulness of the environment to human beings, you know, putting human beings at the center of the universe. The fact is the environment has its own inherent rules and laws, and we human beings have to learn how to abide by those. It's more a matter of putting nature at the center of the discussion rather than human beings. Now, of course, that's a controversial idea. It was then in the 1980s. It still is. The Foundation for Deep Ecology was established, I think sometime in mid-90s. And what they've done is to produce a whole series of these coffee table books, one on clear cutting, another called Fatal Harvest about modern industrial agriculture, and on and on. They approached us, Post Carbon Institute, with the idea of doing this book. They already had most of the photographs in hand. And the way they do these books is it's not a they're not produced with the idea of selling them for profit. The book is available. I mean, if you want to go to Amazon.com, you can buy a copy for $30. But most of the books are going to be given away to environmental organizations to use in their work and to policymakers. We want to change the conversation, so we accepted this idea and worked with the Foundation for Deep Ecology for several months to to develop the essays in the book, and we're very happy with the final product. It, as you said, it's really an amazing object. When you call it a coffee table book, the book is so big you can almost put four legs on it and make a coffee table out of it.
You could. Every time, like walking out with it when I first received it and then walking back today, people go, wow, what do you have there? And by the way, folks, books are, they're no more $2 books. So the book lists $50. So the fact that you can get it on Amazon for $30, and its size over 8 pounds, and it's quite large. And, well, I would ask you this, Richard Heinberg. Your books, for instance, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, The End of Growth, others like that of the other 8 books you've written, those are kind of handy. You can throw it in a backpack or just sit and read it. This presents almost a – it can't go any farther than your coffee table. So in that – what was the idea of having a book this large? I know why it appeals to me, but it may be the same reason why it was decided to put it out in this format.
Right. Well, one reason is simply the imposing reality of the book itself. I mean, if you see it on a coffee table, you're going to open it and flip through it. And we've accumulated some photos now of this book on the coffee tables of representatives in Washington, senators, and so on, because they've all received copies of it. And when people see it, it's just, this amazing thing that they want to display, and it kind of, insinuates itself into people's lives just by its very nature. But the other reason we wanted to produce a book like this is that, it's one thing to talk about energy, to talk about mountaintop removal and tar sands mining in Alberta and fracking for natural gas in Pennsylvania and so on. But it's quite a different thing to actually see these landscapes. And we have, big 2-page color spread photographs of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico back in 2010, and on, including pictures of giant wind farms and solar farms. And, in every case, it's just an amazing... Well, blight on the landscape is all I can say. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are some forms of energy that are going to be better for us than other as time goes on. But the reality we wanted to portray in this book is just how much it takes to produce the amount of energy that we're using. We're using staggering amounts of energy, and no matter how you produce it, it has staggering environmental impacts.
Yeah, my guest is Richard Heinberg, and he has written the introduction to the book Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. It's a huge book, and the photographs, as Richard said, are just so striking that it brings home the scars that we've inflicted on our planet. And by the way, it is not just all doom and gloom, although parts of it certainly suggest that. The final chapter is what we're for, and it lists the things that can be done that really have to be done. Richard Heinberg, you certainly, I mean, the books that you've written, seems like you, when I was approached to interview you, I didn't realize you had just written the introduction. It seems like you could almost have written this whole book yourself, given what you've published previously. So why this variety of writers, and what do they bring to the coffee table, if you will?
Well, there's an advantage to having many voices, and in this book we have the voices, for example, of Amory Lovins, who's the energy efficiency guru. We have a former head of the CIA who's talking about the geopolitical implications of energy. We have farmers and ranchers, as well as energy experts, talking about the environmental impacts of fracking and other forms of energy production. So, when you hear it from many different voices, and these are people with expertise in various areas, it makes more of a kind of mosaic of understanding. And you can literally dip into the book anywhere. You don't have to start at page one and read it sequentially to the end. Another thing the book does is to raise the energy literacy of readers, and we thought this was a really important goal because as important as energy is, very few of us actually have much background or education in how to evaluate different energy sources and what's the difference between different energy sources. So we thought it was really important to start with the basics, concepts like energy return on energy invested, the laws of thermodynamics, and so on. So in many cases, even people who work for environmental organizations talk about energy all day long and yet have never been exposed to some of these basic concepts.
Mm-hmm. The book is Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. It has 30 essays on the problem and several on what has to be done to fix our planet. My guest is Richard Heinberg, and he has written the introduction. You can go to resilience.org, resilience.org, and I'll have to find out more about the book, and I think you can order it from there as well, Richard. Can you? Or you can go to Amazon, and there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. We have been approaching as a society environmentalism for, well, over about 50 years or so. Rachel Carson, Lewis Herber began sounding the clarion call about what's happening to aspects of our world. I think, what was it, 1970, they began Earth Day. And if anything, it seems like things are getting worse. You've been at this so long as well. Does a discouragement factor begin to creep in? I have to say, it does with me.
Yeah, well, you know, some things have gotten better. It's easier to breathe the air in Los Angeles today than it was in the 1970s. But, you know, for the progress that we've made, there are areas in which we've actually slipped back really significantly. If you look at where we are with climate change, for example, or the fact that, you know, in order to have cleaner air in this country, what we've basically done is shifted manufacturing to China, where the air is worse than ever. And of course, Beijing, for the past couple of weeks, has had air quality so bad that, you know, you practically can't see your hand in front of your face. So, yeah, it's a situation where unless we grasp the basics, we're going to just be putting out fires. And the basics have to do with the energy sources that we use and the form of the economy. We have an economy that requires endless growth, and we live on a finite planet. We can't continue doubling our energy consumption and our materials consumption every two or three or four decades into the indefinite future. We've reached the end of that road. We can't continue to increase the amount of energy that we're using. We have to find ways of living within nature's budget of energy and materials.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, that's one of the basic messages of the book.
The book is Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth. Richard Heinberg, my guest, he's written the introduction. The end of growth, of course, that is like almost suicide for a capitalist society that always has to be expanding. Sometimes successful corporations, their stock drops because they don't meet the growth expectations. And when you start looking at the idea of China and India being markets for cars that they never were, and I don't, did this Tata car ever get off the ground? It was going to be about $3,000.
Oh, yes.
Oh, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's not enough oil. I mean, whether the listener thinks there's peak, we've reached peak oil or not, it isn't there. I mean, if everybody consumes like us here in the U.S., the middle class particularly, it's curtains for us. We can start handing it over to the sea creatures, I would say.
Yeah, well, this notion of perpetual growth really got going in the 20th century. And the 20th century was remarkable in all of human history because with cheap oil and electrification, We did grow the economy very rapidly for many years, and I think economists looked at that and they rather than recognizing it for what it was, this sort of one-time only bonanza based on the extraction of this super energy-dense portable fuel called oil, they assumed that it was all because of the magic of the market, and as long as we got the structure of the market right, then economic growth would and should go on forever. They didn't bother to do the simple math of compounded interest. You know, if you have something that's growing at a few percent per year, that it has a doubling time. For example, 1% annual growth has a doubling time of 70 years, 2% annual growth has a doubling time of 35 years, and so on. The math is pretty simple. So if China's economy is doubling, or excuse me, if China's economy is growing at 10% per year, that means it's doubling in size every 7 years.
Mm.
Now think about that. How many times can China's economy double, going from, you know, 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16? You know, every 7 years. Well, not much longer is the answer to that question. China's already using half the world's coal right now. So, you know, in another 7 years, will China be using all of the world's coal? Well,
no, I can't.
No, it's not going to happen. There are limits, and we're reaching those limits.
Well, people would say, yourself and the Post Carbon Institute and other groups like that, as I said in the introduction, this is Chicken Little. The sky is not going to fall. We've had problems before, but science can probably create alternatives, even powering this huge industrial system via alternative energies. And the other phrase, a catastrophist, which I am. I'll just real quickly, I came back from one of the trips I took to Cuba, people, regardless of its authoritarian government, it's made a number of strides in the environment. And someone said, what do you think, to me, Peter, what do you think it will take for us to come to some realization here? And I said, unfortunately, I think it's going to take a catastrophe. And, I mean, hopefully books like Energy, Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth will kick people in the butt. But am I a catastrophist? Are you? I mean, are we Chicken Littles?
Well, you know, I think the sustainability revolution of the 21st century will be led by crisis. I hate to say that. But if that weren't the case, I think we'd already be much further along than we are in terms of the great energy transition that will characterize this century, the transition away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy sources. It will be led by crisis, and we're already seeing that crisis emerge with extreme weather events around the world, with increasing industrial accidents like the Deepwater Horizon disaster and the Fukushima nuclear disaster of 2011. So as these crises happen, we do adapt and we do respond. The Japanese, for example, have turned off all but two of their nuclear power plants, and that has meant that they've had much less energy than they otherwise would. And so the people have actually adapted in a remarkably courageous way. They're, you know, turning down their thermostats and turning out the lights in factories so that there's only just barely enough light to see by to do the work. Wearing, you know, sweaters and coats in the wintertime rather than turning up the furnace. And they're doing this voluntarily rather than turning those nuclear power plants back on because they know what a risk they are. I think we'll all be adapting in similarly courageous ways as we understand the immense costs of trying to keep this economy growing in the ways that it has in the past, you know, trying to continue increasing the amount of oil that we're getting out of the ground, even though we're way past the point where we're finding, you know, easy, cheap oil like we were in the 20th century. Now it's a matter of tar sands and tight oil from North Dakota, all of which have much, much higher environmental risks and impacts. So, you know, as these crises come, we want to have ways for people to adapt that are less strenuous and that lead us in the right direction over the long term.
Well, I wonder, too, the impact this kind of thinking has on people. I remember listening, which I usually listen for about a minute and a half, to Rush Limbaugh. And I remember he was just bloviating about these environmentalists, they want to take your SUV away. And that's true to some extent. And I think people say I'm always talking bad about my wife on the air. But, like right now, I am wearing a T-shirt, a thermal top, and a sweater. And this is the way I'm at home. And I have the temperature pretty low. My wife says, it's freezing in here. And I look and she's got this thin cotton top on. So we've culturally become Rush Limbaugh is an easy target for, anybody from the center to the left. But the idea is we've become culturally used to being able to, walk around the house in a T-shirt, no matter, if it's 10 degrees outside like it is now, or to have these enormous cars that get 12 miles a gallon. So, as an individual, you say, you go up to everybody, go to the person with the biggest SUV, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm all for the environment, and I recycle my, my bottles every Thursday. That is a cultural barrier to environmental common sense.
Huh? Yeah, it is. And culture does change, though. In crisis, people find different ways of behaving, and that's actually happening already here in the U.S. If you look at vehicle miles traveled, the history in the U.S. is very clear. It's always up, up, up. People buying more cars, bigger cars, driving longer distances to commute to work and so on. Well, that's changed just since 2008, since the big financial crash. Vehicle miles traveled has been on a downward trajectory. People are driving less. Now, is that because the government instituted some kind of policy that to limit the number of miles that people can travel? No, it's just people making up their own minds individually in their own households as to what makes economic sense. And I think we'll see more of that. We just need the right incentives and opportunities in place so that as people adapt, as I said a moment ago, they have good choices in front of them.
We only have a few minutes left with Richard Heinberg. Let's not leave it on just on the problem, because there are solutions. We are in a very innovative species, as you can, as we look at our historical trajectory of how we've developed and what we surround ourselves with. And it might take a different type of surrounding, because in the book, Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth, there is a whole final section of what we're for. And you mentioned energy literacy. But there's lots of other things. You mentioned just conservation as well. If there was a post-carbon institute wish list for Congress, though they're pretty much bought off by the energy folks, and I say I laughing with what do they call it, graveyard humor. What would be your first bill that you would submit to Congress?
Well, carbon tax is something that just about everybody who takes climate change seriously sees as the best policy going forward. And, if we put a price on carbon and then take the revenues and then redistribute those revenues to families across the country, it's revenue neutral. It's not putting more money in the hands of the government, politicians and government regulators. What it's doing is making the real costs of our current energy choices more obvious. The fossil fuel industry gets a tremendous bonus from being able to dump the results of using their product into the atmosphere for free. But that has a real cost that society as a whole has to pay, and it's going to be paying that cost for a long time to come. So unless we get the real cost of energy right, then, it's very difficult for us to make that adaptation. So that would probably be the first thing, just put a price on carbon.
Well, I want to thank you so much for for being on the broadcast. Richard Heinberg has been my guest. I would I'll talk about this book in just a second, but I also want to recommend his book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and also The End of Growth. And the Clarion Call is here. It's been in different voices for the last 50 years. This particular book, this 8-pound, as it and I think in the publicity here, it's accurately an accurate adjective, compelling edifice of education. It's the huge book. It's incredible photos, and it's something that, like when I had it at my house, I had people over at my house, and everybody was just kind of going through it, and everybody said the current word of exclamation, wow. And it is a wow book, but it's also necessary for, and I don't mean to sound alarmist, but necessary for our survival. Richard Heinberg, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, it's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much. Thanks for doing the show.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Hey, I'm looking at my little pocket edition of the Constitution and the First Amendment. When people think of the First Amendment, the first thing they think about is freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, all the rights that we should have as citizens. But it's rare that people realize that the first clause in there, it says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and then continues, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So concerned were the founding fathers of what state-designated religions did to the body politic. And yet we've seen the intermingling of religion and the political state to a high degree. There's always huge debates. Religious conservatives say that liberals are trying to kick religion out of the public square. The other side would say that religion should be a private matter and not be intertwined with government. Well, there's been a number of very important court cases, and probably maybe the first one comes to mind is the No Prayer in School one in the early 1960s with Madeline Murray O'Hare. But there was another one before that, and it's chronicled in a brand new one-hour Peabody and Emmy Award-winning documentary that tells this story of a woman's battle to really make that First Amendment come alive. It's The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. And it is produced and directed by Jay Rubenstein with narration by former MASH television star David Ogden Stiers. And it recounts, well, let's do this. Let's bring in the man who made this all happen, Jay Rubenstein. He's on the road in Northern California. Jay, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Sure, thanks for inviting me. I should correct you. It's Rosenstein, not Rubenstein.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm mixing you up with a friend of mine.
That's not a problem, as long as it's a friend.
All right. Jay Rosenstein. Yeah, that's very important. Yeah, it is. Boy, I didn't even thought of that. But okay. Thank you for the correction.
Sure.
If we edited this, I would edit it out, but no need. All right, Jay Rosenstein, tell me the film, the genesis of it. This is a fairly obscure case that I know through the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but how did you tumble on it?
Well, I tumbled on it because I live in Champaign, Illinois, and this case was born in Champaign, Illinois. And so it's always sort of been part of the story. The case has been part of the sort of folklore of Champaign, Illinois. And I just knew very vaguely that sometime in the 1940s there had been some sort of Supreme Court case. And I really didn't know any other details other than the woman who had done it was Vashti McCollum. And I didn't even know if she was still alive for that matter. So, I became interested in finding out more about the story, and I actually just picked up the phone book and looked under McCollum, and her name was listed, and I dialed up the number, and there she was. So that was the first time I even realized she was still alive.
Well, and this is recently. How old is she? Must be in her, like, 80s or 90s.
Yeah, well, she died in 2006, and so she died at age 93. So she was about 91 or 92 when I first contacted her. So, yes, she was definitely getting up there in age.
Well, tell us Vashti McCollum's story and how the importance of it.
Sure. Well, first, let me tell you the importance of it first, because, as you said, it's a very obscure case, and yet it's unbelievably historically important in terms of the history of the United States and the history of the Supreme Court and the First Amendment in the United States. So the case represents a lot of firsts, and the first being this is the first case where the Supreme Court ever stopped a religious activity from taking place in a public school. So you mentioned, for instance, the school prayer case that happened in the early 1960s, which is a lot better known than the McCollum case. But the McCollum case is the very first time that the court steps in and starts this idea of separation of church and state in public school. And in fact, it is the case where that phrase essentially gets constitutionalized by the court. So lately there's been a lot of sort of debate about the fact that the exact wording, those exact words, the phrase separation of church and state, don't appear in the text of the Constitution. And that's true, they don't. But they become constitutionalized in the ruling in this case of McCollum versus Board of Education. It's also the first case where the Supreme Court rules that the the First Amendment actually applies to bodies of state government, not just the federal government. As you mentioned, it starts off with the phrase, Congress shall make no law, and Congress, of course, is the federal government. And this is the case where the first case that's won where the court applies that to bodies of state government. And in this case, it's the school board, because public school boards are part of state government. So that's the importance of the case, generally. As far as Mrs. McCollum is concerned, I'll try to be very brief about the story. But in the 1940s, it was very common to have religion instruction classes in public schools. And generally, they were almost exclusively Protestant instructional classes. And so when these classes finally came to Champaign and hit her older son, who was in fourth grade at the time, she objected to it. She basically thought that that religion shouldn't be taught in public schools, that it was a matter for the churches, and of course there's different kids of different religions. So she didn't allow her son to participate in this class. And what would happen is the religion teacher would come into the public school and give the class right there during school hours. And so since her son was not allowed to be in the class, they had to figure out what to do with him. So they had to take him out and put him somewhere, and eventually they put him out in the hall where they put kids who, were behavior problems. And that caused him to be hugely ostracized, picked on, abused, et cetera. And essentially she got angry and decided to sue the school board, and that begins the whole process.
Well, it's interesting that you actually received an award, the film did, the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association, which says it was the best nonfiction television program about law and legal issues in 2011. So it may be obscure, but it obviously is a good documentary. It'll be available on PBS stations, and you can check your local station here in Detroit for the exact date and time, or around the country if you're listening elsewhere. You can also go to Jay Rosenstein's website, thelordisnotontrial.com. Tell us some, what's the meaning of the title?
The meaning of the title actually comes from something that happened during the trial. And so it's the first day of the trial, which is taking place in Circuit Court in Champaign, Illinois. And I should say this trial was very much a huge media circus of the time. This is 1945. And many in the press were comparing it to the famous Scopes trial, the monkey trial. So media from all over the country were covering this, and it was a big circus. But the first day, apparently a man, a spectator, came walking into the courtroom carrying a Bible under his arm. And he walked up to one of the attorneys and said, "I've come here to testify for the Lord." And the attorneys turned to him and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but the Lord is not on trial here today." And so that's the genesis of the title. But I also want to mention that Vashti's middle son, Dan McCollum, wrote a book with also a very similar title. He has a book out called The Lord Was Not on Trial. And also I should mention, for people who are interested in learning more about the case, I would also recommend his book as well.
And Jim McCollum, the child in question, who's now an older adult, is still active in the movement to keep church and state separate. And in fact, I was just looking online, and he is at this Lake Hypatia observance that the Freedom From Religion Foundation carries out every day. Did you have, what they say, that kind of the phrase, a dog in the fight? I mean, did you want to make like an atheist film? Was that your intent in this regard?
Well, no. I would say that to some degree I do a bit have a dog in the fight, and the reason why is because I have two children who go to public school who are Jewish, which means they're part of a religious minority. And so I feel very strongly that it's destructive for both the government and for religion to be intermingling the two. So I certainly don't want my kids to have to go to school and be forced to take courses or be indoctrinated in some other religion. I feel as a parent that that's my role. It's not the government's role to tell them how to pray and what religion, but it's mine. So, you know, in that way, I would say, like any other citizen who has children in public school, you know, I do have a dog in the fight. But you mentioned the Silver Gavel Award that I won, and I'm extremely proud of that. because it really, it says that I got the legal stuff right, and that this is not an activist film, and it's not pushing an agenda, but rather it's a film that really educates people about not just this story, but just all these concepts, separation of church and state and the First Amendment and the religion clauses in the First Amendment. And so the American Bar Association essentially has put their seal of approval on it, and I'm really very proud of that.
You should be. Jay Rosenstein, you're talking about events that happened almost 70 years ago, pardon me, in the Lord is Not on Trial here today. What constitutes the film in terms of who were you able to talk to? Is Jim McCollum the son of Vashti McCollum, who sued the school district so her son wouldn't get religious instruction? Is he in it?
Oh, yes. I was able to interview Vashti McCollum and Jim and Dan, who's the middle son, and some other people, a few of whom were children who were involved in the trial at the time. One of the most difficult things was, of course, as you mentioned, it happened a long time ago. And unfortunately, when I started doing the film, Vashti was the only adult who had been one of the primary people in the case who was still alive. So in other words, all the other major players had died, and the only other people who were alive who participated in the trial had been children at the time, like her son Jim, who was 11 years old at the time. So really it's Vashti herself that I think provides the primary voice in the film, and I'm so happy that I got a chance to spend some extended time with her before she passed away.
And there, in the community itself, she received incredible negative response from many community members, right?
Yes, and it wasn't just in the community she lived in, which is Champaign, Illinois. You know, the McCollum family really became the enemies of mainstream organized religion in the United States. And she really became, public enemy number one, particularly of, sort of the mainstream national Christian organizations who very much characterized this trial as a battle between atheism and Christianity. And Vashti McCollum very much was opposed to that idea. She never felt that it was a battle of atheism against Christianity. It was simply a battle over the Constitution and what the First Amendment really means. So, locally in the community, yes, the family was totally ostracized. Her husband was working as a professor at the state university, and immediately, members of the legislature called and tried to have him fired. Huh. The house was vandalized. Their cat was lynched. They suffered all kinds of abuse, tons of hate mail and phone calls, hang up phone calls and those kind of things. And the family really just pulled together and stood strong and were able to endure this. Although Jim, the oldest son who the case was built around, things were so bad for him that they had to send him away. Wow. And he got sent to New York to live with his grandparents to finish out school because he was taking such abuse he couldn't stay there anymore.
And they were getting, the family, the Vashti family, was getting 200 letters a day, and she was called a communist, and it was...
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, at this time period in American history, it's just on the cusp of where... being labeled a communist is perhaps the worst thing you can be called at the time, because we know beginning in the late 40s and then on into the early 50s what happens to people in America if you're labeled a communist. And, we're on the cusp of, all the McCarthy hearings and all those other things. And people at that time were very much equating being an atheist with being a communist. So in other words, if you didn't believe in God, you didn't go to church, you were an atheist, then you must be a communist.
Hmm. Jay Rosenstein, tell us the legal voyage of this. So it began just in a circuit court.
Correct.
And how did it progress through the state and then into the federal court system?
Sure. The trial took place in the circuit court, and it was heard before a three-judge panel, which was very unusual, and the legal scholars who were involved in helping me vet the story to this day are still very stumped by the fact that that two additional judges were pulled in. But the main judge in the case, his name is Frank B. Leonard, actually had a huge conflict of interest. He actually had previously been an attorney for the school board, who were now essentially being sued. So he probably should have recused himself, although I don't think it would have changed the outcome one bit, because she was going up against such an ingrained community standard. So she lost at the circuit court level and appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court and went to the oral arguments at the Supreme Court hearing and watched as the justices were dozing off during the arguments. They weren't even paying attention. And so she knew right then she was going to lose at that court, and she did. She lost at the appeal at the Illinois Supreme Court. And so all that was left was the U.S. Supreme Court, and they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I don't know if how many people are aware of this, but the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear a very, very small number of cases. So just the fact that you appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court does not guarantee they'll even take your case.
And it would be, I mean, they're selective oftentimes politically. So they knew they were taking a social and political risk by accepting this case.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so they accepted the case, and she eventually won an 8-1 decision at the Supreme Court level.
So it was pretty clear to the justices, when you have that almost unanimous vote, that the religious instruction in public school was unconstitutional, did not meet the standards of the First Amendment, which says Congress shall establish no religion. Well, but then they were still left with prayers in school, right? And that went on. So
it's interesting. If you look at there's three decisions by the Supreme Court around this issue of religion in public school that come very close together. And there's really no consistency between the three, which is very unusual. The first case that hit was right before the McCollum case, and this is actually the most famous case of the group. And I don't understand why, because the outcome is the plaintiff lost. But it's called the Everson case, or the Everson bus case. And in that case, taxpayer money was used to bus children to religious schools. And the court ruled in a 5-4 decision that that was acceptable. Although, in their opinion, they first used this phrase, separation of church and state. So they used all this rhetoric about there having to be this separation of church and state, and yet they voted against the case. Then, quickly that was followed by the McCollum case, which, as I mentioned earlier in the program, became the first case that is won, and it's won by a resounding vote, that this idea of separation of church and state does belong essentially in the Constitution, and that's how the justices are going to interpret the First Amendment. But then, just a few years later, there was another case that was very similar to the McCollum case. The only difference was, instead of there being a religion class being given during school hours in the school building, they actually took the kids out of the school building and brought them somewhere else for the religion class. And then in that case, the justices ruled that was acceptable. So you have these three decisions in a row, which in many ways kind of bounce back and forth between, feeling that there has to be strong separation versus there shouldn't. So, it's very confusing.
Well, I should say that your film, The Lord Is Not on Trial, and that is the website as well, if you just put .com after it, doesn't really address, and I'm sure it didn't address itself before the justices at the time, whether or not religious instruction was good or bad, or whether it had a good effect or a negative effect on students, but just under our Constitution does not belong in the public sphere.
Well, correct. Let me say two things. First of all, yes, and the issue is not even so much whether religion is good or bad. That's not the issue in the Constitution. The issue is that the government has to treat all religions and non-religion equally. So that's really the key. So when you give religious instruction in school or being given by any body of government, it's not possible to do that in a way that treats every single religion there is equally and non-religion equally. So the issue always comes up. The problem is that you're essentially promoting or playing favorites to a certain religion. But, you know, I do have an issue with this idea of the public square, and it's a phrase that's used a lot, and you used it, and I hear that a lot,
sure.
This idea that we're kicking God out of the public square. And that's absolutely false. What the First Amendment is about is it's about government institutions, not the public square. And what I mean by that is, you know, you walk around, drive down any street in America, literally, and this is, you know, public property, and you see symbols and expressions of religion everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can freely go into a public park and hold a religious service if you want. Nobody will stop you as long as you're following the rules of how the park is used for other events. So religion is everywhere in the public square. It's on our currency. You can't get away from it. The issue is that it has to do with government institutions, that government institutions can't be promoting a certain religion. But as far as it being in public, it's everywhere in public.
My guest is Jay Rosenstein. He is the producer and director of the documentary The Lord Is Not on Trial. And you can go to thelordisnotontrial.com. Also be a link on my site, peterwerbe. .com as well, W-E-R-B-E. When you interviewed the plaintiff who said her son should not be receiving religious education in a public school, and finally they won, but she received just such terrible treatment throughout the country and from her neighbors, how did she evaluate it all after it was finished?
Well, you know, after it was finished, you know, she said something. She says it in the film, and her son said, you know, she said this her whole life, this very same line, which is just, I knew I was right. There was no question in my mind. And so she believed that from the first day, and she, you know, she went to her grave fully believing that she was right, that what was happening was a violation of the Constitution. And even though her taking that stand was very unpopular at the time, she knew that she was right, and the court sort of confirmed that to her.
Did she stay in that city?
You know, she did for a long time, and then later moved to Arkansas, and then moved back to Champaign, Illinois. So she was living in Champaign when she died. Yes, and so things actually. Fairly quickly after the trial was over, or after the Supreme Court decision was over, things actually kind of went back to normal in a way in terms of their treatment by the community. You know, there were always some people who harbored some resentments and such, but as time went by, those became less and less. And one of the great ironies of this whole story, I think, is that, you know, her middle son, Dan, who as part of the family was completely ostracized by this town, Champaign, Illinois. As an adult, he actually got elected mayor of Champaign, Illinois, and served three terms as mayor, and is still the official historian of Champaign, Illinois. So in a way, the family kind of got their revenge, and eventually were able to be totally accepted by the city, and that's how things are now.
This is an incredible story, and yet any challenge of religion is often, as we just hinted at a little earlier, any challenge to religion's role in public life is taken by some as being anti-religion, and you assured us it was not, but more about the Constitution. And yet that PBS is willing to put it out there. We often talk about PBS not willing, being less and less willing to take any chances. Was this a chance? I mean, have they gotten any negative criticism about your film?
None that I know of.
Well, good. I shouldn't suggest. Maybe I shouldn't have even. I thought you were going to say,
No, and that's okay. But, again, I think, you know, when you see the film, you know, it's a historically accurate film, and I take very, you know, great pride in trying to make it as factually precise as I possibly could. And although it's told primarily from the point of view of the family who filed the case, the McCollums, and what they went through. You know, it's not a film that's particularly pushing an agenda, so to speak. You know, this is what happened, and this is how the McCollum family experienced it. And, you know, the film does not argue the rightness or the wrongness of the Supreme Court decision. And I set out originally not to do that. The fact is that the decision has been made, and it is what it is. And no arguing about it today will change the fact that the decision in the McCollum case is 8-1 for Vashti McCollum.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jay Rosenstein. The documentary is The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. It's a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning documentary and tells the story of Vashti McCollum, who says didn't want her son to have religious instruction in public school. It is being shown on PBS. You can check your local station for exact date and time. And you can go to thelordisnotontrial.com, where the DVD of it is available as well. And it'll be a link on my website if you missed all of this. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Jay Rosenstein, thanks for being my guest.
Oh, thanks so much, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
What? I want it now!
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I want it now!
The Riff.